Thank you. My name is Clint. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. There's a certain frantic serenity in the room, and I always... At first I thought it was just the excitement of the first seasonal AA conference, and then I realized that a big factor was the sunshine. You haven't seen the sunshine for 120 days. And then I realized, too, that a lot of us had an interesting experience this morning of waking up in a room that was strange to us wearing a bracelet on. That'll get you asking some questions, won't it? But it's a great conference. I love being here. I love getting a chance to spend some time with Linda and hanging out with her, with my wife. And I'm so glad that Don and Jackie have been here, and I'm so looking forward to hearing Don in the morning, and I know you will enjoy that very much. And I want to thank Harlan and Zen and Rosa and all of the people in the committee and throughout that have worked so hard to put together another great Seaside Conference. I've heard about this conference for years, and I'm very glad to be here. Don't do that again. My grandma used to do this. She'd look at me in church and go, I grew up in the Church of the Air in Billings, Montana. I got baptized in the Yellowstone River early March one year when I was about 13 years old. Yeah. I didn't find God, I'll tell you that. I didn't find much of anything for about 3 days. Scared little Clinty that day, I'll tell you. Those days in Billings when, at first I wanted to believe what they were saying about God, and then I gave it up. I knew it wasn't true, and I knew for me it would never be true, and I was glad that they had, some of them were nice people that obviously believed all of that, but it was quite clear to me fairly early on that it wasn't ever going to be anything that I would be able to believe in. I had no sense of what they were talking about. I had gotten mad at my mom real early in life, and it was a simple enough thing. Most of us have gotten angry out of misunderstanding and disappointment and hurt, and we get so angry and so shut down that we live out our second and third choices in life, and I did that. My mom one day, you know, when I was 4 years old, I adored my mother, and she adored me. I have a twin brother that some of you know. He's named Carl, and it was he and I and my mom. My dad was overseas. I knew that I was my mother's favorite, and she would, it wasn't necessary, didn't have anything to do with reality, but it was just so sweet to me, you know. And so when she tucked me in at night, we'd say our prayers and we'd giggle and we'd whisper our little secrets. I just loved it. It was just so safe and so wonderful. And the day when she said she was going to bring home another baby from the hospital, that was okay with me. I was okay, and she did. She brought home this little baby. And I didn't seem to see her for a while after that. All her energy and time and effort went into that. And they had a little room set aside for this kid and a crib in there where they let her sleep, and I had no idea they intended to keep that kid. You know what I mean? And it was so shocking to learn that. I wanted to get where it was. And I would go into the room where they kept her, and I would encourage her to move out. I would give her a little thump on the head. And my mom caught me and scared her to death, and she picked me up and she pitched me out into the hall, and before I hit the wall I knew that she didn't love me, and I knew she never had. And she and I went to war. Boy, did we go to war. I wouldn't do a thing she said. And she got angry. I mean, just like angry. And the beating started and things got pretty colorful around there. And we just went to war. She would tell me to do stuff and I wouldn't do it. She'd get me to mow the lawn if she hit me hard enough, but she couldn't get me. I always had a little line I drew in the sand, right? She couldn't get me to clip around the sidewalk. Wouldn't do it. Took a lot of beatings and I wouldn't do that. And we just kind of parted company. And I was so mad at her because of the betrayal that I mistakenly thought it had gone on. And when I was 13, we were living in Denver, and she just gave birth to a little baby. I guess I was 12, and she had a new baby. There were four of us now, and she found a lump, and we moved back to Billings, where we always did when there was trouble, and we always hooked up with my grandma and grandpa, and seemed like we always lived in the cellar of whatever house they had, and this was no exception. And it maybe took my mom a year to die, and when I was 14, I'm standing at the low-rent part of the cemetery in Billings, and they're putting her in a grave, and I didn't cry. I did not cry. I stopped breathing deeply that day, but I didn't cry. I was so furious and so angry. And you know what it comes to for a kid? You don't love me? Great. I don't love you. I don't love you. And I stood at that grave in the spring, and I don't love you. And I tried to make that true, and I had to keep saying it because it never was true. And 2 years went by. We moved, and I was at a party after a football game, and somebody offered vodka, passing around, and I had vodka that night, and my life changed. I knew that night that I wouldn't long be without that stuff. And I drank until I was 29, and I drank as hard as I could. I got married twice, had 3 sons in that time, got divorced twice, and got to a point where I was going to jail a lot. And living in what I called a garage at the time, and it was a building that had been cut up into 4 little rooms. A couple of years ago, Linda and I were over there. She said, "I want to see the garage." And we drove down in that area, and she looked at me, she said, "That's the building there?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "That's not a garage. That's a shed, is what that is." And I had one of those little rooms, and what was a shed? I looked again, no car had ever gotten in that place. There was no way to get a car in there. It had 4 little rooms occupied by 4 little male alcoholics. There was a shower out someplace. I didn't go there personally, but I heard it from you. So clear that what had started at a party after a football game in high school was coming to an end. I knew Skid Row was about three weeks away, maybe. The party was over, and it had been over for a while. And I'm walking along the street one day, and a bail bondsman that I had done some business with saw me, and he said, "Where are you going?" And I don't think I gave him any kind of an answer. He said, "Come here. I'm going to take you someplace today." I didn't even ask him. I did not ask, and it couldn't have mattered much to me, because wherever he might take me was, I had been there, in a way. If we're going back to jail because of some old warrant, fine, I can do jail. If we're going to county hospital, maybe they'll give me a jar of pills. They were doing that in those days. Maybe we'll go to Camarillo, which was a fidget farm open in those days down in Los Angeles. That's all right with me. Maybe they'll find that brain tumor I have. You know? I had a... one of my few possessions was a radio with a clock in it. And the reason I knew I had a brain tumor was because I couldn't get the radio to turn off. Even after I pulled the plug out of the wall, that radio just kind of plays, you know. Not bad music, but I had no choice in the matter. That guy hooked up with me again at noon that day, this bail bondsman, and he put me in his car, and we drove across Glendale, California, a little town down there outside of L.A., and wound up in the parking lot, going up a long flight of metal steps hung on the side of a building, and I walked into a little room, had the word Alano Club over it, Alano. I didn't know where I was, I hadn't any idea, nor much curiosity. But I sat down there with you. Nothing has been the same in my life since that time. And I didn't get sober then. I stayed, I went without a drink for 3 weeks, and then I was drunk for two. And I woke up in the shed one more time, terrified as always, needing a drink as always. People used to, you know, waking up in jail in a way is kind of a relief, isn't it? Because when you wake up in the room, that little nasty, smelly room with the wet mattress and the sticky linoleum floor and that awful odor and the rest of it, you need a drink. And when you wake up in jail, when you know where you are, you don't need a drink as much. You know, it's like, you're not going to get one, so just relax. Pretty soon the felony tank empties and they line us up and we go down, and Ken White, the judge, was calling the criminal calendar and then the misdemeanor calendar, and you just listen. Listen for him to say guilty with an explanation, Your Honor. I like that, because if the judge seemed interested in the explanation that guy gave, it may become my explanation. And so that morning when I woke up in the little room in the shed, I was in the room, and it wasn't good news and it wasn't bad news. It was just a terrifying way to wake up, but everything was. And the only place I went that day and the only place I knew to go, I didn't have any money and I didn't have any booze. And I hadn't eaten in a week, and I'd been very drunk. But I made my way over to that club and walked up that flight of stairs. And there was a guy there in the middle of the morning that morning that was doing his job in AA. He had the club open. He had the coffee on. And he asked me, "How are you doing?" He's a nice man. I said, "I'm not doing so good." He said, "What happened?" I said, "Well, I got drunk and let everybody down." "Oh," he said, "are you alcoholic?" He knew the answer to that, but he wondered how I was doing with the question. And I said, "Yeah, I've been an alcoholic about a month now." He was gorgeous, because he said, "Oh, you're an alcoholic. And you got drunk." "Yeah. Yeah, you would do that." drink. He wasn't being flippant with me, but he was just kind of letting me have the simple dignity of the fact. He said, alcoholics drink. And they drink without even wanting to. I later heard somebody say, alcoholics drink no matter what. No matter what. And he said, so you'll do that? He said, you didn't surprise us. In fact, he said, if you want to surprise us, get a job. That'll surprise us. Go to work. Do you think those mics, the speakers are working up above there? So I liked this guy because he took. I got it that he knew what he was talking about, and I also knew that he had threaded the needle for me because I will always drink, and I knew that. I had tried, and if you're new here or kind of new in your experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sure you've tried to quit. It doesn't work out very well for us, this quitting thing. It's just not what we do. You know what I mean? There's like people that can quit. Here in Seaside, there are people that can quit, and they're not in this room. You know why? Because they quit. They quit. And we quit, but it doesn't seem to take. You know what I'm saying? It's like the first time I quit, I was on active duty at Camp Pendleton. I told my commander, I'm going to quit. I thought it was getting almost as bad as my wife thought it was. And so I'm going to quit. And I got a little boy, and I don't want to. And I told her I was going to quit. I told my commander I'm going to quit. I told the base chaplain I'm going to quit. I told the base psychiatrist I'm going to quit. He turned out to be a dermatologist, but I told him anyway, I'll quit. I'm going to quit. I told the minister in town. I told too many people. Because 6 weeks later, boy, I am just as drunk as I've ever been. Because I'm going to quit. But I am already beyond human aid, and I don't have any way of quitting. And there's no human power that's going to get it done for me. And I did not know that. The insanity of alcoholism was rampant, and I thought I could quit. It's an insane notion, and I thought I could quit. There is it's so interesting to notice that we celebrate birthdays here in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I don't know of anybody that ever took a one-year cake and said, I knew a year ago I would not drink anymore. We don't know that. Chuck Chamberlain, you say, if I'd have known that was going to be my last drink, I would have had two. This is for us. If you're new here and you think that we quit and you don't have what it takes to quit, and so maybe you can't join us, I got good news for you. A lot of people have gone a long time here without quitting, but I didn't quit. Because I couldn't quit. And if you can't quit, welcome home. I got even better news for you than that. Lamont came up here and read the steps, chapter 5, that first part of it, those 12 steps, which is the outline of recovery, as it's expressed in the book. And if it was about quitting, I know she would have gotten up here and said, step one, quit. Knock it off, goddamn it. And she didn't say that. Not in there about quitting. And you know what it says? Basically, it says, step one, you've got to get that you are toast. It's all over. You are through. And once, and I got that morning that I came back to the club and that guy told me, alcoholics drink and you're going to drink. Alcohol is going to be in your life all your life. I knew he was right. I knew that. I couldn't have said it myself a minute earlier. But when he said it, when I heard you say those things, I knew that was right. I got it. And I didn't drink after that. And I knew I would always drink, and I didn't drink, and that was on the 14th of August, 1966. And I didn't drink anymore. And I don't know, and there's nothing that I did to earn that. There's nothing that I did. Nothing. I wouldn't have known, would you? I mean, what would we have done to earn a day or a year or whatever? But 32 years, Jesus, that's, I can't, I'm not even interested in it. You know, why would you do that? You have to die, is what you have to do. You have to die. You have to get, we're so full of these, what Bill talks about, old ideas. The old idea that I could, if I just managed well, if I eat along with the booze, if I stay out of that one beer bar, don't be playing pool when you're drinking, you know, and then you're going to be okay. Slam back some of that pickled pig's feet. Maybe that'll work. Well, it's just a suggestion, even. These old ideas are so great, and they follow us into sobriety. We hang on to them. We let some of them go around booze, but we hang on to them. They're so great. Linda and I woke up a couple, 3 months ago now. We were laughing about it. It was a Saturday, I think, or a Sunday. And I said, what do you want to do today? And she said, let's give up an old idea. I went, what the hell is that? I've been so blessed with good AA members in my life, but you don't really want that first thing in the morning. It's like waking up with one of these bracelets. It scares you. But I said, okay. And she said, you go first. You know, I had been chewing on something. We were talking about it. In this book called Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that God will constantly disclose more to you and to others. You and to us. Well, I don't have a sense of constant disclosure, do you? But I've been taught to take that book literally, to believe that the sentences that were written in it were true for the men that and women that wrote it, and true in that they apply to me today. And so I'm wondering about this sense of constant disclosure. And the more I chewed on that, the more I realized that I got all kinds of rules around disclosure. I think it has to come directly from God in some way or another. I mean, I know in one form or another that He loves me through people. And particularly the people in AA have been so incredibly instrumental in my life. But I've got a sponsor. It's okay for him to make a disclosure to me. I'll listen to that if it comes on Tuesday at 4 o'clock especially. Got a little rule. Nobody my sponsor can make a disclosure to me. No, that's not the way it's going to go. My wife can't make a disclosure. I can't. The guy in the next lane can't make a disclosure. I don't want to hear about that. I got all the, no wonder I don't have a sense of disclosure, because I got all of these rules that bat all of that away. And I was so grateful to be able to notice that, to open up to the idea that these rules I've created around these things are nothing more than a series of complex ideas. And they're old ideas, and they're not useful. And I've been hearing a lot more. So some welcome, some not so welcome, but I've been hearing things since I gave up that old idea that I get to make the rules about where the disclosure is going to come from, because it's like not quite the point. And it's all my ego just acting out and doing a bunch of crap. But I didn't know any of that in 1966 or 1967. I had some wonderful, wonderful experiences. I remember at 9 months of sobriety, they had given me a job on Monday night in Glendale to set up the chairs in the meeting. That's very important stuff. It really is. If you got a home group and you don't think it's the best home group in the world, get a commitment at that home group. Get a job there. That'll make a big difference. Do you have something? And I loved doing that because it seemed to give me the right to take up a seat at the meeting. But I noticed on Monday night, once a month, there were some people, four or five, that would meet, and they would come into the meeting, and they were loving and laughing and carrying on. They looked so attractive. And then they would disappear, and they'd show up again after the meeting. And I asked somebody, and they said, that's the H&I committee. They go down to a hospital or an institution, and they put on a meeting there, and they meet here to go down there, and then they come back here. And they looked like they were having such wonderful fun, and they were so attractive to me. And the night they asked me if I would go with them, I was thrilled. Thrilled. And I went with them. I got in Bill Christian's old car, old Chrysler, in the parking lot. There were six of us. I sat in the middle in the back seat, and we're bumping along the freeway, and they're chattering and laughing and loving one another and singing their love songs, those songs of AA to one another. And I just loved it, and I just sat there just soaking it up. It seemed so incredibly sweet to me. And we got down the freeway for 15 minutes, and we pulled off, and we pulled into Metropolitan State Hospital, and they said, we're going to put on a meeting in that brick building right there. That's the Nut House. And I'm all right with that. And then we park, and we get out of the car, and it hits me. We're going to the Nut House. And I just knew. Nobody had to tell me. I knew that six of us were going in that place, and five of them were coming out. And my first thought was, I can outrun every one of these over here. My next thought was more interesting, because I thought, if they think I belong in there, maybe I do. I mean, you know, I was... It's funny, isn't it? We ask these questions. I was touched when Marcia said, there's got to be a better way to live than this. I was touched when I heard Gail at a meeting one night talk about the alcoholic's prayer. These are prayers. These are prayers. And the story that she told is worth repeating, because she's at the podium looking elegant and lovely like the AA women that come here and stay here, and she's articulate and attractive and looks a little cynical, which I liked, you know. Like, if she's going for it, maybe there's something here. And she's talking about coming out of a blackout in her apartment in Hollywood, sitting on the mantel over the fireplace with her cat. Her cat's up there with her. And I'm liking her better all the time. She had a little cat food and vodka up there, a little something for everybody, you know. Yes. I'm thinking about asking her to dinner, you know. This is one of my people. She'd understand my drinking. And she's also talking about the alcoholic's prayer. And part of this chaos that's in her life includes the fact that there's 4 inches of water on the floor, which is why they're sitting up there. And that's because she had started to take a bath last Tuesday and the whole deal got away from her somehow. And I'm going, yes! I'm liking this lady a lot. And then she said it, like Marcia said it. She said, the alcoholic's prayer. And it goes like this for her. Jesus, God, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And I had said those prayers. And you had said those prayers. We've all said them. They don't feel like prayers. They're angry and they're profane and they're prayers. They're the best we can do at the time. And I don't think that when God overtakes us, He cares much, that those are angry prayers. We've just reached out. And we've died the death to everything but God, and He finds no obstacle, and there is an elegance in that power that's transformative. That's transformative. In a moment. And the rest of it is evidence. And I'm 9 months sober, and we're walking to this nut place, and I'm thinking, if they think I belong in there, maybe I do. And the only piece of God's grace in it that was available to my conscious mind is that these people have better judgment on the issue than I do. Because I could have outrun every one of them, and I knew that, you know. But I kept walking, and we went in there, and they brought the patients down, and we put on a meeting. I just sat there. And an hour, and their patients are back upstairs, and we're walking out into that warm California evening again. And I sat in the middle of the back seat and rode home and slept in my own little bed that night. And I can remember it very clearly. Remember it very clearly. Remember how these prayers matter. And if you're new, and you know you can't stay here, ask. Ask. It is astonishing. We need, I think, more than anything, I have needed a God that's big enough. Big enough. I never had, of all of the gods that I could have selected, I picked one I didn't even like. Little tiny guy that needs my help every day to keep me sober, you know? Not one that wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. No. Not one that gives me dreams and gives me an opportunity to live out those dreams. Not one that lets me have the life today that I have that is nothing more or less than an answered prayer. But a little tiny one. And you might, it is important, I think, at the outset, if you're going to go through these steps, that you get yourself the biggest God you can. Not some kind of a God that'll keep you sober if you behave. Not some kind of a God for whom you always have to do stuff. Have you got something you want me to do here?
Yeah, go ahead. Some guy appreciated it.
All right. If you own a silver Subaru and a Washington plate 5-23-84, you've got about 5 minutes to go out and meet the guy that's hooking your car up to a tow truck. Silver Subaru, Washington plate, 5-23-84.
Thank you. Keep coming back.
We were just at the most touching part of my life. Oh, a Subaru. Did we rent a Subaru? What the? No, I. I was 23 years sober, and I had brought everything into my life that I thought would give me power. This is about power. This whole chase is about power. I knew when I was 5 years old that I don't have enough power. I'm not big enough for this world. I knew that. And right underneath that, I knew two other things. I knew that I had to go get some power someplace. And I knew I had to keep you from finding out that I'm not big enough. And I never did get big enough for this world. I never did. I'm not tonight. And that's something that is so wonderful to know about. But I chased power. I mean, I am a power seeker, and maybe you're a power seeker. There's some people here in Oregon that don't care anything about power. But I don't think any of them are sitting in this room. Lack of power would not be a dilemma for us, would it? If we didn't dig power. We want power. And we've tried everything we can to get power. And I ran out of power, even my own, and I ran out of the illusion of power. And I, you know, it seems to me in chapter 8, there's an extraordinary sentence that says, God has either solved his drink problem or he has not. Now that's an amazing piece of information. Because if that means what it says, it means that on the 14th of August 1966, my obsession to drink was lifted. It might even mean, as it says in the book about three places, that I don't have any more choice today than I did then. It sounds almost heretical to say, as that guy in the book said, my old way of life was by no means a bad one, but I wouldn't go back to it even if I could. But what if we're just as stuck in sobriety as we were in our drinking? Wouldn't that be a shocking kind of a notion to bring to the table? Like, you mean that Don said it one night, Christmas Eve, about 6 years ago, in a little meeting in Santa Monica, California, we've been given a gift, and it's a strange gift, because we have the rest of our lives to become comfortable with that gift. And we come in here thinking, man, I'm glad that's over with, and I guess now I'll manage my life a lot better. And when they talked to me of power, I knew it was all about me tapping into power that I could use to manage my life. And so I had an opportunity when I was 5 years sober. Somebody said, you ought to go to law school. Well, I did. I went at night, worked during the day, did all of that stuff. And then when I was 9 years sober, the state of California gave me a license to practice law, which is pretty colorful because they wouldn't give me a license to drive a car when I got here. And I did that, and I learned the skills involved to trying lawsuits and doing all of that, and there was naming the paper stuff, and I was making money and having some fun, and I had the right house and the right address and the right car and this and that, and all of it looked like, and I had an image is what I had. More than anything, I have an image. Which is so interesting because I'm the only guy that can see my image, you know. Working for an image is an interesting thing. When I was in the Marine Corps, they taught us to camouflage tanks and make them look like trees by throwing branches on them. But my tanks always look like tanks with branches on them. And that's, I just look like a donkey trying to keep an image in place. You know? But it was very important to me to have this image. Really important. And I was 23 years sober. And all of a sudden, everything that I had brought into my life to give me power was taken out of my life. And it happened in about 100 days. And I was absolutely terrified. I didn't know what I had done to get it. And I didn't know what I had done to lose it. And I just, the relationship was gone. And the law partnership was gone, and the income stream was gone, and the house was gone, and everything was gone. Everything that I depended on to give my ego some stuff. That is very frightening. Very frightening. And if you have it as confused as I did. You don't know that I didn't know the differences. A guy down in San Diego said one night, I didn't know the difference between everything and nothing. Because the everything that I lost turned out to be nothing, and the nothing that I was left with turned out to be everything. The whole thing. What had happened? Yeah, that's right, because from there I became teachable. And none of this really worked fast for me because the months were painful and very frightening, and I didn't know what I was going to do, and I tried to kickstart that law practice, and it starts up again, but it's like it's a new start, and I'm 53 years old, and I'm sober 23 years, and I don't know what's going to happen, and all I know is, and I really never thought I would drink, although I considered that was a possibility. But I hadn't drifted from AA in any sense, but I was still attending AA. I mean, I was sponsoring guys. I was doing what I had said I would do. But it had become so flat for me. Like there was, what's next? And I flew back, I guess it was Nashville or wherever that was. I had to go talk in Nashville. I had nothing to say. But back there were a group of guys out of Denver and all over the place that had one thing in common. And Don, the guy you're going to hear tomorrow, was one of those men. And one thing they had in common is that they had actually taken these steps. They had taken them. And they knew about them. And they knew where the power was. And they knew it wasn't their power. And they knew that they could tap into that power, not so they could manage their lives, but they were tapping into a power that managed their lives. I mean, it was just quite an amazing look at it. We sat up in somebody's room, Don's room, I think, until 2 in the morning, or Joe's room, somebody's room, and I listened to these guys talk. And I knew they had something that I didn't have. And I knew that they weren't scared the way I was. And I knew that they didn't have all of this crab and all of that stuff. And one thing led to another, and by the next January, one of the guys that was in the room had moved out to Santa Monica, and we were sitting down every week, and we were going through that book, and we started at the beginning. And I had the most amazing series of experiences out of that book. The most incredible stuff began to happen to me. I had really come to see that 23 years of sobriety was a flat gift, and I had done nothing to earn it. Nothing to earn that gift. I had asked for it, and I had wanted it, and I needed it, and it had been, yeah, you got it. You bet. Anything else? No. That's all I want. I'll take it from here, and thanks a lot. No, I was under the illusion that I had to do something to merit any further favor. I thought it was up to me to do something that would make God look down and notice and say, oh, let's do something nice for Clint today. And that's never been the drill. That has never been it. It isn't up to me to do anything for God. It's up to me to live my life in such a way that God can demonstrate through me what He will do. I'll tell you how powerful these steps are. About a year later, and I was keeping in touch with Don by telephone from time to time, and I was, by this time, I don't know where I was in the steps, maybe step 4 or 5, I don't know how many months had gone by, but I was on the phone with him, and I said, Don, you know, I'm still shocked that all of the stuff that I had in my life went out of my life in about 100 days. And he said, yeah, and I said, what do you think that was about? And he said, well, what were you doing just before it left your life? And I said, well, I'd been sober in AA, and I had gotten real AA slick. I had gotten real, I had the patter down pretty good. I knew the drill. I knew to get to meetings on time, and I knew to, you know, whatever we do. But it got real flat for me. There was no joy in it. There was no richness in it. There was no sweetness in it at all. And so I told Don, I felt like I should really get serious about these steps because I never really had. And he said, what'd you do about that? And I said, well, I said the third step prayer. Somebody's been down this road before. He said, you said the third step prayer? I said, yeah. He said, did you do step 1 and 2? No. He said, well, did you at least notice that little piece at the end of the third step prayer where it says we thought well before taking the step, making sure we could abandon it? I said, I didn't really notice that. He said, where it says that we asked that this attachment to self be removed. Relieve me of the bondage of self. I said, yeah, I noticed that. He said, well, what were you bonded to? and I began to get it, you know, the sun's coming up. I said, well, it was bonded to my image. He said, well, what was that? Well, it was my income and my house and all of this stuff. He said, you asked to be relieved of that? Now, people that hear me talk like that, see, it's an explanation for me that quieted my mind down, because it first of all let me know that all it was a request on my part. Secondly, that I was in the midst of something extraordinarily powerful. I need not look any further for power. I mean, you ask and you are getting it. But people generally, and I hasten to tell you, it need not have been that way. If at step two I'd really answered the question, is God everything or nothing? And that was so sweet to be able to get that question answered, because the way they had me answer it, I thought, you know, you ask me, is God everything or nothing, and I'm at step two? I don't know the answer to that. And it says, we got to figure that out. That's a real question. And you need to know that. And I'm going, I don't know. I mean, I don't think he's nothing, but is he really everything that he's... Well, and the question, the way that I was asked to answer that question was to answer another question, and that is this: what five things will I not give up for a better relationship with God? Oh, I've got five things, you bet. You bet. I think when I made my list, I had seven or eight of them. And so I think it was seven, and so number eight on my list of priorities is a better relationship with God. God. Well, at least now we know what everything is. Everything is those eight things, with God at the bottom of the list. And now I have the answer, my God, he's not everything. And the instruction came back, you know what, if you said a prayer, another prayer, you said one and he removed the obsession to drink, you got that, don't you remember that? Yes. How about another prayer? Take me into a place where I'm willing to have all of this reprioritized in favor of having a better relationship with you being the most important thing in my life. And that's doable. And it's amazing that a guy like me, with all of that time in AA, can still tap into that power. And within 2 weeks, I was to take a look at my list and pray at night and look again in the morning and see if anything had shifted, and you can tell that they're shifting. And in a couple of weeks, I still have all of those things. The things that were in the way for me were like anger and control and sex and lust and all the, you know, green and groin, the standard stuff. Sounds like a steakhouse, doesn't it? Green and groin. Now God is at the top of that list. Is anything removed out of my life? No. No, we're not there yet. But we're reprioritizing things. That is so critical, because if I'd have done that the first... When you do that and then go to step three and say, relieve me of the bondage of self, it doesn't require a huge shift. Because there was no real reason that that house should have gone out of my life. There was one reason, and that is that I didn't own it. It owned me. And all of that was like that. I mean, it's an amazingly powerful... When you think about the inventory process, it's about power. I looked at that resentment. You know who I resent? I resent people that seem more powerful than me. Even a guy on the street in Los Angeles asked me for a buck. At that moment, has the power to make me feel weird. And he goes on my list. What about that fear inventory? That's, who am I afraid of? What am I afraid of? I'm afraid of what looks like power. More power than me. The sex inventory is the same thing, because it's my way of trying to grab power out of a situation that is not a legitimate source of power. And to the extent that I've misused that relationship and that relation, I've been very unhappy and made other people unhappy. And I got to take all of that and look at it. Because it's about power. And my grab for it, my senseless, obscene, mindless grab for power. And you get to that, and now my idea of God, because of a step two exercise in the book that requires that I define those spiritual terms, has changed immensely. And I've gotten a lot of evidence by this time that there's an amazing force that's alive in my life and is constantly bringing things to me. And the day comes when you say, are you willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of that power? And the answer, if we've done the first two steps correctly, if we've done them thoroughly, if we have done them with that kind of an abandon, is yes, yes, you betcha. And I'm still willing. I'm still willing. That is a daily process. That is something that, because my ego will ride up there and get control and do all of that stuff, and that's the reprieve from that, I think, is the daily reprieve. I loved it. Marsha reminded me of something else today. There was a lady, about the time I'm at step 6 and 7, I'm in Northern California, and there's a lady up there named Joyce that's given a talk, and the talk touched me a lot because it's part of her talk, and she was maybe 20 years sober at the time, but she was 10 years sober on this time she was talking about when she decided that she wanted to get over her fear of heights. Step 6 is a catalog of all our character defects and also our old ideas if we want to do that. Step 7 is, and we are gladly ready to let those go. And step 7 is just asking a God that's powerful enough to take them away to do just that. So that we get a new mind out of the deal. That's the entire psychic change that Silkworth talks about. And I'm kind of at that place in my sobriety and then going through these steps. And I'm listening to this lady talk, and she decides at 10 years of sobriety that she wants to get over her fear of heights. And so she decides to take skydiving lessons. Isn't that great? I wouldn't have done it that way, but she did it that way. And she's finally gets down to the solo flight, and the airplane's coming over the drop zone, and in the drop zone there's her husband and her kids and the women she sponsored, and even her ex-husband shows up in the drop zone. And, I don't know why, but he's there. And the chute was wrong. She packed the chute wrong. Yeah, and I mean, she's up there telling the story, so you get that she lived through it, but she hit going a lot faster than she was supposed to be. And the way she described what happened next is, she said, I spent the next 18 months in the hospital learning how to urinate again. And I went, wow. And her husband left her, but her ex-husband came back into her life as a friend, and one day he's in the hospital in this rehab place that they had put her, and they're talking. And they chatted quite some time. And he finally said, Joyce, let me ask you a question. And I guess Marsha was there when that chute went into the deck. And her husband said, let me ask you a question. She said, yeah. He said, what was that all about? She said, you mean jumping out of that airplane? He said, yeah. She said, I was just trying to get over my fear of heights. And he started to laugh. And she said, what are you laughing at? And he said, all you had to do was humbly ask. And I went, oh my God. Isn't that amazing? I mean, we've tapped into real power here, and I'm jumping out of airplanes all my sobriety, you know, because I have a point to prove. Isn't that astonishing? I went through a lot of my sobriety thinking that my folks had done it wrong, hating my mother, hating my father. And you know the problem with that is I know I'm the little advertisement running around telling everybody what a bad job they've done. And if my mom wants me to have a happy home, I can't do that, it might please her. I mean, why would I be living in a shed when I was 29 years old if it wasn't to make my point? Of course, I was drinking, but It's interesting, isn't it, how we just diminish the quality of our lives because we try to grab our own power. We have all of these silly things to prove to the world that nobody's watching anyway. And it never once occurs to us to try to be useful. We don't like that word, useful or service, because it sounds too much like servant. And it isn't the game at all. I got on the road at step 9. I had to. I had a lot of people to talk to, a lot of people to talk to. There have been a couple of more wives, and there have been relationships that were painful for everybody involved. There had been work relationships that didn't have anything good going for them. I had paid back the money, and that was about it. I had gotten some money. If you're going to make financial amends, here's the rule. If you're going to make financial amends, take money. Simple enough, huh? Take money. Somebody down there used to say, they don't even want your money. They just want their own back. I went to Portland to see my brother. I went to Georgia to see my other brother. I went to kneel at a grave in Roanoke, Virginia, where my dad was. I went a lot of places, and I sat down with a lot of people in Los Angeles, and the format is very simple. I'm here to clean up the past. Here's the harm that I think I've done. Do you need to tell me how that made you feel? Do you need to tell me about any other harm? And the real question is, what can I do to clean this up? What can I do to set this right? And you listen, and you listen, and you listen, and you get your marching orders. And I finally wound up at that grave in Billings, where I hadn't been for 40 years in the wilderness, stomping around there. Finally found that little marker. I was given a sack by an Al-Anon friend of mine, a sweet lady, who knew I was. She and I were up there speaking at a little thing in Billings. She gave me a shot. She said, take this out there. You're going to need it. I said, what's in here? She said, take a look. There was a liter of water. There was some clippers. There was some garden seeds. There was Kleenex. And there was some paper towels. And I was very touched that she did that. My sponsor told me to write a letter, which I did. I finally found that little grave, and I started to talk to my mom. And I was doing sort of in neutral until I started to clip around the edges of her marker, the things she couldn't ever make me do. And the tears began, boy, they really began. And I spent a lot of time there that day, several hours. I'd think I was done and I'd get up to go and I'd have to come back. I went down the line and found my grandma's grave and saluted her. I came out of that graveyard that day in the low-rent part of the cemetery in Billings, and I knew something I hadn't known since I was about 4 years old, and that was my mom loves me. And I talked to her. I mean, we're like cooking along. Funny thing about this deal, this fellowship of the Spirit. Funny thing. That next week, I'm in Los Angeles. Corinne, the Al-Anon, called me and she said, there's something you have to know. I said, what's that? She said, the Al-Anons Billings have taken on a project. I said, yeah, what is that? She said, they are going to make sure your mother's grave always looks great. And they do that. I mean, that is just blows you away. It's just amazing. In that book, they talk about the fellowship of the Spirit, don't they? There is that paragraph that addresses the whole thing about, you know, you may be worried as you go along this way that you won't be able to meet those of us that have actually reported our experience here. But we will be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And they are with us as we take these steps and move through them, as we grab that set of tools and apply them to our lives. What that they call this a little chip of a book. Isn't that something? They talk about the fact that what at first seemed a slender reed turns out to be the loving and powerful hand of God. And I can feel that here. That's going on this weekend. There is a fellowship of the Spirit here, and I know you can feel it. I got guys that I'm sitting down with, they're hungry for this thing, and they come up, they're in their 11th year, or their 13th year, or their 17th year, and they say, talk to me about this. And we start, and we do it. And these guys now are coming out the other end, and have been for a while, and they get out there, and they're making amends. And they're amazing me. I got a guy that's a contractor. He put a lot of remodels together and a lot of additions on homes and built a lot of homes, and he's kind of a high-end guy, and he had to go out and contact a bunch of people. Say, I did your house. Yeah, I know. What can I do to make it right? Well, you can fix the leaks in the roof for a starter. He spent a year and a half of his life, about half of his time for a year and a half, at no charge, for free, cleaning that kind of stuff up. He did that. I don't need to tell you that his business is thriving. It's a generous universe. We always get that opportunity. Tom is another guy who Linda and I love. He's just such a sweet man, and he's supposed to be in prison. He's still got a bullet in his butt someplace. And he's a felon. The only odd thing about the guy is that he is producing little TV spots for NBC down in Los Angeles tonight. I mean, he's like an accepted and valuable member of the community. He's a contributor. But what he did is he had a specialty when he was drinking and using, and then his specialty was burglary. And his territory was South Pasadena. And there were 19 or 20 places that he remembered. And he began to knock on doors. Hi. Simply hi. Did you live here 5 years ago when the place was burglarized? Yeah. I did that. And I want to clean it up with you. And he did that. What do you need to have me do to make this right? And for the most part, people were generally forgiving, but it's a scary thing. Boy, you got to be tapped into power to do that. The prayer becomes, take me to my next amends and give me the power to make it, and we need power to do that. We need power to do that. He called me, it was the last one he had to make, and the last amends and the last house. Somehow he had never felt that it was right to go there. And he went there. I said, go and call me. He called me late that morning. He said, I'm done. I said, that's it? You've made your amends. You finished it up. He said, yeah. I said, how'd this last one go? He said, it was quite amazing. I knocked on the door and I told him why I was there. And they invited me in, an elderly man and woman. And they asked me a lot of questions about that burglary. But they were kind to me, and I asked him finally at the end, what can I do to make this right? And I said, what'd they tell you? He said, they told me that I had already done it, because until right that minute, they had thought their son had burglarized their own. I mean, we are tapped into something that is so powerful with such ripples that we have no way of knowing what goodness and healing it will bring. This is the sweetest thing on earth, and I've been given the sweetest life I can imagine, and it came out of absolute failure. And today I'm under new management, and I'm glad I am. And if you are new here, I hope you run into a Don Prince along the way. I hope that your trip finds you not only grabbing this stuff, but stepping up to the plate and passing it on, because there's something so sweet about giving it away, because you get a front row seat to a transformative experience in another person's life, and you will know beyond a shadow of a doubt that you're useful. Thank you.